Hi, everybody. It is time for your favorite Sun Sounds of Arizona show, Points of View. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen, and on today's show, we're going to be reading from the April 2024 issue of The Atlantic magazine. And let's get right into it. This article is headlined, Jodie Foster's Life on Screen. Since childhood, she's struggled with one question. How much does she want the public to know her? It's by Jordan Kistner. Jodie Foster has spent much of her career playing the lonely woman under pressure, a young FBI agent in training, having an underground tete-a-tete with a cannibalistic serial killer, a scientist launching into space solo, a mild-mannered radio host who becomes a vigilante after strangers assault her and kill her boyfriend, a mother whose child vanishes in the middle of a transatlantic flight, a wife whose husband is having a suicidal psychotic break and will talk to her only through a hand puppet. It's not a relaxing career. There are exceptions, of course. Freaky Friday in 1976, with which Foster made just after Martin Scorsese's Grizzly Taxi Driver, was a family-friendly romp. But her 58 years in film, which began during her preschool days, has been almost entirely devoted to outsider characters, women who are emotionally isolated, fighting to be believed, striking out perilously on her own. For a long time, this is how Foster liked it. She spent many years avoiding roles that invoked too much entanglement with other actors. I wanted to be the central person, she told me recently as we sat in the quiet back room of a West Village restaurant. She cracked a smile. I felt like other people were going to mess up my stuff. When I call her performances to mind, the image is always of her face, pale and serious, in the middle of an otherwise empty frame. Clarice Starling staring down the barrel of Hannibal Lecter's gaze, or Dr. Ellie Arroway braced inside her spacecraft in contact. I kill people off when I'm in the development process, Foster said. I'm like, why does she have to have a dad? Why does she have to be married? She has a tendency, she said, to whittle people away till it's a solitary journey. I keep finding myself wanting the elegance of that. Foster's long search as a woman alone on camera has mirrored, in some sense, her own feeling of loneliness. As a child actor, she realized early on just how punishing celebrity could be. She worked hard to protect her personal life. She doesn't do social media, and she isn't the face of any products. For decades, she refused to publicly acknowledge her sexuality, even as the media speculated about her relationships with women. I am a solitary, internal person in an extroverted external job, she told the New York Times in 2021. I don't think I will not ever feel lonely. It's a theme in my life. In the past year, however, she's taken on two projects that are not solitary journeys at all. In the latest season of HBO's True Detective, Foster is half of a twosome. She plays a police chief working on a strange case with a younger officer. In development, Foster reversed her usual argument. She insisted to Issa Lopez, the season's writer and director, that the younger character should have the main arc. In the movie Naiad, for which Foster has been nominated for an Academy Award, she plays Bonnie Stoll, coach and best friend to Annette Bening's Diana Nyad, the marathon swimmer who famously swam from Cuba to Florida. Nyad is new territory for Foster in several ways. It's a total sidekick role. Stoll and Nyad are platonic life partners who were once briefly lovers. They are completely enmeshed, but Diana is clearly the sun, ambitious, reckless, prone to delusions of grandeur, and Bonnie, the moon. Bonnie devotes her life to assisting, caring for, cajoling, and managing Diana. She's the first out lesbian Foster has ever played. Just as notably, the performance is perhaps the lightest in Foster's filmography. Her body is buoyant and loosed, tanned and laughing, where Foster's performances have so often been tightly held, full of strain. This role is full of ease and humor. Foster told me that she took the role in Naiad because she wanted to learn something about how to sustain partnerships and connection, as Bonnie had. It's a skill she doesn't think comes naturally to her, and she's eager to shake off some of the solidariness that has for so long been part of her self-conception. For somebody who is interested in privacy, she told me, I am obsessed with being understood. This, she said, has been a lifetime struggle. Foster was a precocious child, exceptionally good at sussing out how to perform in whatever way she desired. She started acting when she was 3 years old. Her first role was as a shirtless toddler in a Coppertone commercial. She never had a real choice about it, she says now. She just did what she was asked. Foster was born after her parents divorced. They were living in Los Angeles, and her mother, Brandy, started taking her to auditions. By the time Jody entered first grade, she was the primary breadwinner, supporting her mother and three older siblings. She told me that Brandy, who managed her acting career until she was in her 20s, would frequently panic about money, a panic directed mostly at Jody. I was it. There was no other income besides me, Foster said. She was uniformly excellent, an excellent student, an excellent employee, excellent at taking directions. Her savvy, almost world-weary quality made her compelling, even unsettling, as a child actor. When she was 9, Foster was mauled by a lion on set. Afterwards, she told the story coolly as an entertaining antidote for the press. In 1975, when she was 12, Scorsese cast her in Taxi Driver as Iris, a runaway who takes up prostitution. Until then, she'd played earnest pipsqueaks in Crest toothpaste ads, husky-voided prairie kids, philosophical tomboys. Her performance in Taxi Driver was shocking for its sophistication, not because of the movie's sexual material, which Foster claimed in interviews to be unruffled by, which what she disliked was the hot pants and tall heels, but because it's so self-assured, canny, and nuanced. When the film came out, Foster spoke fluent French at foreign press events, though she had to ask for French word for prostitute. She traded witticisms with Andy Warhol, who offered her a Bloody Mary in Interview magazine. The role earned her an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress. But she also learned to protect certain parts of herself. She told me about being followed around by a documentary crew when she was 13, which she hated but didn't protest, believing it would be an obligation to her career and family. When the cameraman proposed accompanying her and her friends to Disneyland, though, she went to her mother in tears. Being filmed at an amusement park with her friends seemed like too much. At Disneyland, she just wanted to be a child, unobserved. Counterintuitively, acting itself felt like a space of privacy and control. Foster remembers being relieved that her mother would stay in the trailer reading magazines while she worked, because the set, as the acting she did there, felt like hers alone. She couldn't get inside my body and take that experience from me. She could take a whole bunch of experiences from me, but she couldn't take one, Foster told me. That's a deliciousness to loneliness. There is nothing like the loneliness of lying in a pool of fake blood at 3 a.m. in Prospect Park with 175 people around you moving things and whatever, and knowing they will never understand what you're going through. In 1981, when Foster was a freshman at Yale, John Hinckley attempted to assassinate President Reagan and confessed that he'd done it to impress Foster, with whom he'd been obsessed since seeing Taxi Driver. The explosion of attention and speculation was traumatizing. Death threats were dropped in her dorm room. Paparazzi combed through her trash. She slipped on ice during a confrontation with a photographer and lay on the street sobbing while the photographer yelled, "I got her! I got her!" A year and a half later, Foster wrote an essay for Esquire titled, "Why Me?" about the media spectacle that surrounded her. She wrote about desperately wishing to be treated like a normal college kid and what it felt like to realize after the assassination attempt that this would never happen, that she was helpless in the face of a stranger's projections. "Good actors are essentially good liars," she wrote. I raise my eyebrows, you think I'm sexy. I dart my eyes, you think I'm smart." Her tone was both anguished and resigned. If she cared about having the public know her real self, she'd been trained to turn that impulse off. "Being understood is not the most essential thing in life," she concluded. She was 20. In 1988, a few years after college, she starred as Sarah Tobias, a woman who is gang-raped and then fights for justice in The Accused. Foster's version of Sarah was more defiant and rough-edged than the producers and the directors Jonathan Kaplan wanted. She couldn't bring herself to soften the character. What felt truthful to her, she said, was to play Sarah as angry and tough as well as wounded. But after shooting, Foster began to worry that maybe she had done the film a disservice, that she had delivered a victim who was too strident and off-putting. When she saw an early screening, she was so convinced that audiences would hate her performance that she considered applying to graduate programs in African-American literature, believing her acting career was over. But her instincts had been right. Sarah's toughness, her rage, won Foster an Academy Award. Then, in 1991, came The Silence of the Lambs. Her mother couldn't understand why Foster would do a horror movie right after an Oscar win, much less one in which she played second fiddle to the film's villain, Hannibal Lecter. But Foster was compelled by the role. She saw the story as a gender-flip version of the mythological hero's journey, where a young man's crusade to slay a monster proves his mettle and ultimately transforms him. Clarice Starling became a kind of blueprint for Foster's future characters in movies such as Contact, Panic Room, and Inside Man. Intelligent, alone, duty-bound, vulnerable, but resolute. In the final scene of The Silence of the Lambs, Clarice pursues a murderer through a dark house, which we see her hand holding a gun shaking. That touch was Foster's idea. Clarice's fear, she thought, needed to be as visible as her grit. During these years, Foster cultivated a reputation for being aloof and self-protective. For a long time, she declined to talk about her family and her relationships. She dated women and raised two sons with her former partner of 15 years, Sidney Bernard, without ever acknowledging Bernard in the press or discussing the question of her sexuality. Her experience could make her feel defensive of younger actors. In 2012, when Kristen Stewart was in the Tonight franchise and dating her co-stars Robert Pattinson, Foster wrote an essay in the Daily Beast condemning the media frenzy around Stewart, who, at 12 years old, had played Foster's daughter in The Panic Room. "We lift up beautiful young people like gods, and we pull them down to earth to gaze at their seams," Foster wrote. "If I were a young actor today," she continued, "I would quit before I started." Stewart told me she was grateful for Foster's essay. She said she saw what I was going through, something that needed more words, and I didn't have them, Stewart said. From her late 40s through her 50s, Foster barely did any acting. Partly, she said, this was because she felt she was in an awkward stretch of middle age where she was competing with the audience's memories of a younger, smoother-skinned version of herself. She'd been swearing off acting intermittently her whole career, insisting that she doesn't have the right temperament for it. She's cerebral and introverted, not naturally expressive or emotional. But the 10 years between 2010 and 2020 were the closest she came to actual retirement. Her most significant project during the time was The Beaver, a 2011 film she directed starring Mel Gibson as Walter Black, a man who, despite once having a good job, a nice house, and a loving family, grows so depressed and disgusted with his life that he decides to kill himself. After a failed attempt, he starts living vicariously through a beaver hand puppet, which he animates with an alternate personality. Where Walter is affectless and despondent, the beaver is warm, charming, and driven. Walter is revived and rejoins his life, but he won't interact as himself. Instead, he talks via the beaver and refuses to take off his hand. The film's like it might be a broad comedy, but Foster shot it like the bleakest tragedy. The beaver, Foster told me, is the only way that he can survive when he has to choose between a life sentence or a death sentence. The life sentence is living the horrible life of depression every single day. The death sentence is taking his own life. The beaver arrives as a survival mechanism that will allow him a way forward, though through one he can't live with forever. The Beaver bombed in theaters. Shortly before its release, the public learned that Gibson had been accused of physically assaulting his girlfriend. He pleaded guilty to a charge of misdemeanor battery and had made racist and sexist statements. Gibson has also been in the news a few years earlier after making anti-Semitic remarks during an arrest for driving while intoxicated. Foster refused to renounce him as a friend, insisting that people were more than their worst actions and that she still appreciated the raw and complex performance he'd given the film. Gibson told me over the phone that he knows that he and Foster are nothing alike, ideologically and in every other way. She's a mixture of things, and I mean, I don't pretend to know exactly what that is. She's an enigma. Yet he feels unusually close to her. If she was a novelist, she'd be John Steinbeck, he added. She doesn't waste a word or a thought, and she doesn't waste time. Regardless of its box office failure, The Beaver meant a lot to Foster. She saw the movie as nearly autobiographical, an allegory of a spiritual crisis she herself had experienced. In the years before The Beaver, she found herself in her own deep depression. Her 15-year partnership with Bernard ended. Her sons no longer needed as much attention. She was no longer in the spotlight for her work in the same way. A few directing projects she'd fought hard to get started had fallen apart. I thought I was meant to do great things. And what happens if I don't do any more great things? Like, do I matter? And what am I supposed to do on Earth? What happens if I'm not great? She related to Walter Black, to the despair and self-loathing that led him to seize upon the alternate self the puppet offers, to his unwillingness to relinquish that puppet no matter how much his loved ones begged him to. At a certain point, the survival tool, which has always kept you safe and just kept you warm, which has kept you with your family, it's allowed you to exist in the world. You gotta cut that fucking thing off, she told me, then broke out laughing. You gotta cut that thing off because it's killing you. The way she spit her consonants here, the hardness of her laugh surprised me. I asked what that meant for her. I assume you weren't walking around with a puppet. My whole life I've had a puppet, she interrupted. I asked what she meant. I think it's the persona and doing the right thing, she said. Getting good grades, taking care of her family, positioning herself to win awards. And then you get to this certain point and you're like, this is killing me. This is killing me. I don't know why it's killing me now, but I can't live one minute longer. For a moment, I wasn't sure whether she was talking about herself or Walter. And you know, I have two terrible choices. I either live a life that I hate every single day of my life, or I die. That's it. I only have two choices. But then there's a choice in the middle, which is to change. You have the choice to change. For Foster, change happened gradually over years. She realized that so much of her persona was a coping mechanism, the bravado of the child who told jokes about being mauled by a lion, the false swagger that led her to tell reporters that she'd been less disturbed by the accused rape scene than the men on the set were. You start realizing things like, "Wow, I'm a real blowhard," she said. "I just talk and talk and talk. I've been a blowhard this whole time. All those years I've been a blowhard and nobody told me." She decided that she needed to quit drinking and joined a 12-step program, which demanded the previously unimaginable practice of exposing herself emotionally, not as a character, but as herself, in front of complete strangers. She wondered what it would look like to be a less defended, more honest, wider version of herself. What would that look like in her close relationships? What would that look like with people she didn't even know? "It's amazing how," she trailed off, looking momentarily nauseous. "Vulnerability," she grimaced, "my least favorite word. Vulnerability," she told me, "is code for women, and it's code for what you're supposed to bring to the screen that's nice and girly and everybody wants you to be." She hates when reviews accuse her of showing no vulnerability. "Yeah, I know what that means," she said, shaking her head. "It means," she said, "that some women's vulnerability just doesn't look the way you're used to seeing it." In 2013, Foster received the Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Achievement Award at the Golden Globe Awards and gave a speech that thrust her into the public eye in a new way. "I just have a sudden urge to say something that I've never really been able to air in public," she said on stage, smiling big but looking nervous. "So, a declaration, loud and proud, right? So I'm going to need your support on this. I am single." She paused for an audience laugh that only half arrived. She went on, "I hope you're not disappointed that there won't be a big coming out speech tonight, because I already did my coming out about 1,000 years ago, back in the Stone Age, in those very quaint days when a fragile young girl would open up to her trusted friends and family and coworkers, and then gradually, proudly, to everyone who knew her, to everyone she actually met." It was a perfectly Fosterinian speech in its coyness and strange humor. In a way, she had pre-written fake ad-libs to satisfy her eternal itch for over-preparation. In the contrarian way, she conceded her sexuality while asserting her right not to have come out in public previously. The response from the LGBTQ community was accordingly confused. Some writers congratulated her. Some expressed disappointment that Foster had refused to break her silence about her sexuality until she was old enough to be accepting Lifetime Achievement Awards. Some wondered if she had even broken her silence at all. Lost in the debate about whether she had or hadn't said about her sexuality was a revealing moment that came at the speech's end. It was a plea for connection. A seemingly complete turnaround for the jaded author of that 1982 Esquire essay, who resigned herself to never being fully known. "Jodie Foster was here," she said on stage. "I still am, and I want to be seen, to be understood deeply, and to be not so very lonely." When I asked Foster about what she'd hope to convey when accepting the Cecil B. DeMille Award, she seemed amused that her speech had been criticized as a failed coming out, that I didn't do whatever it was other people wanted me to do for them. "It wasn't a coming out speech," she said. Even in this moment of apparent self-exposure, she insisted, her message was about privacy, about the importance of allowing some parts of yourself to be exclusively yours. There in that speech lay the central contradiction of Foster's life, her desire to be seen, but on her own terms, her dueling impulses to connect and be left alone. From the time I was 3, I've given everything on screen, she said. Everything I have to give up, to give, is up there. And we're a little bit, we're almost halfway through the show, and I just want to take a little break here to remind everybody you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is your favorite Sun Sounds of Arizona show, Points of View. And I also want to remind everybody, like I've been doing for the last few weeks, that Sun Sounds of Arizona now has a mobile app that is just great. If you download it on your phone or on your iPad, it will come up with huge icons that will allow you to listen to the broadcast feeds from Tempe, from Flagstaff, from Tucson. And also, it gives you really fast access to all the shows that are broadcast on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this one you will find in the icon for the entertainment section, and you will find it there. And you'll find you can go back and listen to the show from the top or the last few weeks of shows. It's pretty easy and it's pretty nice. Thank you, Sun Sounds, for the mobile app. Now let's get back to this profile about Jodie Foster. One sunny December morning, Foster picked me up from a friend's house in Santa Monica. She told me that she wanted to get her boba tea and buy a new pair of sneakers. I hopped in the passenger seat as she was removing a pair of cloth tubes from her forearms. She laughed and confessed that they were her younger son's socks. Her wife, Alexandra Hedison, whom she married in 2014, had cut holes in them so that Foster could protect her arms from the sun while driving. Her younger son studies chemistry in college. The socks were printed with molecules. Foster, 61, is slight but emphatic, quick with her hands while she talks. She has refused all forms of plastic surgery or other cosmetic alterations. She told me she'd rather have people say, "Man, she looks like 20 miles of bad road," than "She hated her face, so she got plastic surgery." For her role in True Detective, though, Foster agreed to laser sunspots off her face and arms. She had spent her whole life in Southern California, but her character, Liz Danvers, lives in Alaska. No sunspots for Danvers. True Detective is Foster's first foray into prestige television and her first time back on TV at all in decades. Danvers is a police chief in a remote Alaskan town named Enos, who is investigating the disappearance of 8 scientists from a nearby research station. The entire season unfolds in the dark. In Enos, the sun sets on December 17th and doesn't rise again for almost 2 weeks. Danvers is a familiar type for Foster. She's widowed and angry, half estranged from her teenage stepdaughter, and almost compulsively caustic to the people around her. But as she read the pilot script, Foster found herself more interested in the arc of Danvers' partner on the case, an Amici woman named Evangeline Navarro, played by Katie Reese. The two are adversaries after falling out over an old case that still haunts Navarro. In the original script, Lopez, the director, had envisioned Danvers as a softer, more sympathetic main character. Foster fought to make her an unpleasant foil to Navarro. She read the script and thought, this really needs to be Callie. It really needs to be her journey, Foster said. Her Danvers is skeptical, brutal, somewhat racist, frequently an obstacle to Navarro's desire to seek justice for indigenous women. Foster is the bigger star, but Reese's character is the hero. After a lifetime of being solo in the frame, the lonely woman lying in a pool of fake blood, Foster found great satisfaction in playing a supporting role. Lopez told me that Foster turned out to be very adept at it. If what the other actor needs is for her to look down and disappear, Lopez says, she will do that. It's all about allowing the other one the space they need because she needs so little. Between takes on True Detective, Foster wouldn't go back to her trailer, opting instead to pop over to a couch on set and check in on her fantasy football team. This is a passion for her. She spent several minutes enthusiastically explaining her draft picks to me. Her team had been held back by persistent injuries to the Cincinnati Bengals quarterback Joe Burrow, to whom Foster remained devoted. She read me jokes from the text chain of her groups who she plays with, a bunch of lesbians over 60, and offered a detailed narrative of the previous 12 months of Aaron Rodgers' career. Despite the existential quality of our conversation, the frequency with which doubt, despair, and the threat of meaninglessness comes up, Foster is consistently described by the people who work with her as lively and exuberant. There's a kind of freedom about her now, Annette Bening told me. Christian Stewart mentioned to me that she'd recently seen Naiad and found quite a bit of Foster in her portrayal of Bonnie. Her energy is so stunning in that movie, and it really is very much like her in real life. That beautiful, comforting, warm quality of life. We just got to laugh about it. It's something that she's good at. In one of the most memorable scenes in Naiad, Diana is faltering on the brutal swim from Cuba to Florida. She doesn't know where she is, and she stopped moving forward. Bonnie jumps off the support boat into the water and urges Diana forward, one stroke at a time, knowing that even if Diana is disoriented and in pain, she'll swim for her friend. The scene didn't actually happen. It was written into the film because Foster insisted on capturing the lifelong partnership between the two women, and it feels remarkably real, even to Bonnie Stoll herself. I promise you, if I thought it was me, I thought I was watching myself up there, Stoll told me. I learned things about myself that I didn't know from watching her on the screen. Bonnie's arc in Naiad has some of the intensity that is characteristic of Foster's roles. As she accompanies her best friend through multiple attempts to accomplish something that's probably impossible, she has to reckon with the fact that helping Diana pursue this dream might mean watching Diana die in the process. Diana is at peace with this. Bonnie is not. Bonnie also wonders whether she's given herself up too completely to her friend's quest. What about my dreams? She cries at one point. But there's a breeziness to Foster's rendition of Bonnie, too, that's funny, gruff, comfortable with who she is. She loves Diana without reservation. She's a person with a soulmate. She's arguably the only person with a soulmate Foster has ever played. On our way to the market store, Foster told me the previous night she and Henderson had attended an event celebrating Ellie's Women in Hollywood honorees for 2023, of which Foster was one. She'd been looking around the room at her meticulously diverse group of women Ellie had chosen to honor and wondering to herself why she'd been included. Finally, I realized, like halfway through, I leaned over to Alex and was like, her voice dropped to a whisper, I'm the old queer one. How does that feel? I asked. Her eyes were bright. Feels good. I think it feels good. A few years ago, a segment of a TV interview Foster did when she was 17 started making the rounds on social media. She was at the time a famous tomboy, with a low voice and a habit of wearing suits on a red carpet. For this interview, she slouched in a chair wearing an Oxford shirt and bootcut jeans, an ankle crossed over one knee. The interviewer asked her if she had a steady boyfriend. Foster laughs uneasily and says, no, she doesn't have time and doesn't think about it much. But the woman presses her, what kind of fellow would you like really? There is a disquiet to the way the teenage Foster grins slightly, cocks one eyebrow, swallows hard. A beat passes, and she considers the question, looking down. Huh, she says. I don't know. I suppose I would like somebody who understood my business. When that clip resurfaced, young queer people on social media turned it into a meme. The meme they coined was gay silence. The choice queer people make to let straight people continue believing that you're like them, that heterosexuality is the default. Gay silence is awkward and frightened. Gay silence can have an amusement about it. It looks for a moment like Foster is ready to laugh in the interviewer's face. It can indicate circumstances of tremendous pain. In all cases, it reveals a protective gap maintained between one's true self and the persona constructed for public consumption. The memification of that old clip is a type of hyper-scrutiny that Foster has been subject to her whole life. Ever since she was a kid, people have projected their own narratives onto her, their own beliefs and anxieties and desires. Who knows what Foster actually understood about her sexuality when she was 17? Maybe that's what we're seeing in that interview, is a gay silence. Or maybe we're just seeing a smart kid aware of the ways that an adult is trying to manipulate her into divulging details of her underage romantic life, about which the masses can gossip, speculate, and fantasize. In a sense, it doesn't matter. The queer people posting about gay silence have chosen to hold up this clip of Foster as proof of forebears, proof the queer kids were artfully ducking questions about their presumed heterosexual future lives back in the 1970s. Foster's teenage face, hesitatingly and deflecting, is read as affirmation for their own experience in the world and in history. When I watched that clip again, and after our conversations about the thwarted lifelong desire to be understood, I thought I saw Foster struggling to represent herself in a way that was both honest and circumspect. For a person who wants to be connected to other people and who cares about truthfully communicating the human experience, maintaining a gap between one's private and public self can be fed uncomfortable and less as excruciating at worst. Throughout our conversations, even when she was refusing to answer a question or refusing to answer it on the record, she reached out and touched my arm briefly, looked me in the eye, and smiled as if to reestablish that, despite the completely unnatural circumstance and the boundary that they required, we could still be just two people talking. Her overarching desire, she explained, while hunting for a parking spot near the sneaker store, has been to push for rounded, complicated representations of women who just get to be in the main character of the story. For the most part, sexuality was either minor in the characters that I played or demonstrated how women's sexuality was weaponized against them. She let out a little noise, spying what looked like a parking spot, and swung the car to the left. Was it all that intentional on my part, picking the way that I picked, she said? I'm not sure, but I knew that I just didn't want to be reduced to that. I just didn't want to be reduced to identify as a woman, to her sexuality. Unspoken here was the fact that life for out lesbians in 1990s Hollywood was difficult, often impossible. Lesbians did not get to continue career as top-earning stars of movies that were about ferocious and straight women who emerged victorious. They did not get to have a private life that remained off-limits. I played the lady who got into the starship. I played the lady who fought back in her court case, and I played the lady who raised the kid on her own, who was a genius and who survived the attack and kicked all the asses, she said. And I didn't play the wife of, the sister of. At that point, we were in the sneaker store, which she'd been coming to for years. The sales clerk said hello and told her she remembered seeing her there shopping for her sons when they were little. She chatted with him congenially for a bit, then wandered around taking stock. All the best sneaker designs, she told me, were in the men's section. See, girls have lame colors, she said, taking a sip of boba tea. I looked around for a bright and colorway just what that she'd admired. Wait, but where are the red ones? She gestured over her shoulder, indignant. There, in the boys. The boys have bright reds. Girls don't have anything good. In the end, she bought a pair of black Hokas. Later in the day, she drove back toward Santa Monica to drop me off. I asked her what being understood means to her. What does it feel like? What would it look like? Hmm, she said, and then paused to curse herself quietly for having taken Wilshire Boulevard, which is always a mistake. She let a moment pass. I guess being acknowledged as a nuanced and complex. I was A, but I was also B. I was just not one thing. And that was Jodie Foster's Life on Screen by Jordan Kistner from the Atlantic Magazine, the April 2024 issue. And we have time for another article, and this one is headlined, Why Do Animals Play? Scientists want an evolutionary explanation, but maybe the answer is simply, it's fun. It's by Sally Tisdale in the April 2024 issue of the Atlantic Magazine. Orcas sank yet another yacht near the Iberian Peninsula in November. Members of a pod had been ramming and shaking boats in the area for more than 3 years and had now sunk four. Many observers believe the orcas were attacking their boats, perhaps taking revenge on fishermen. But both boaters and scientists wondered if the orcas were playing, and the marine biologists who studied this group think it may be a fad. The consensus is that they're doing this to show off, the director of science at an ocean conservation group said. As fads do, this one may have spread. A yacht had been rammed near Scotland in June. This is no conciliation to sailors, some of whom have tried to make their own revenge on orcas, shooting at them, lighting firecrackers, and playing heavy metal music underwater to drive them away. We project a great deal onto animals. They are elevated into the ideals of love and fidelity, dogs and horses, and often they are reduced to objects and tools, like cattle and pigs and horses again. Much of humanity's history with animals has been made possible only by refusing to grant them inner lives anything like our own. We can be amused by a parrot's speech and intrigued by macaques that use human hair as dental floss. But many animals live in ways we can hardly imagine. Whales and frogs and frigate birds exist in realms we cannot enter, walled off by complex sensory differences and disparate desires. We deny them individual worth, so precisely known as personhood. This denial doesn't just constrict our imagination, it also constricted research in ethology or animal behavior. Animal play has come into focus as a subject of study only in the past century, and the field is still developing even basic principles. What is play? How do we define it in a species different from our own and from each other as octopuses and crows? The most careful observer may find it hard to avoid biases about what play looks like and means. In humans, many forms of play imitate serious behavior: hunting, courtship, exploration, building, fighting. We recognize play in other species if it looks like our own games. Yet, what looks like play from one perspective may be something else altogether. We may miss play entirely if it doesn't have a human equivalent, or if it appears in an animal we don't believe to be like us at all. In Kingdom of Play, what ball-bouncing octopuses, belly-flopping monkeys, and mud-sliding elephants reveal about life itself. David Toomey, who teaches English at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and writes about science, explores the research into the elusive subject. Toomey has written books about organisms living in extreme environments and about the physics of time travel, and he has a solid handle on the science here. At least 30 hypotheses of animal play are being investigated, though Toomey notes that some are little more than notions. He finds a definition by Gordon Burghardt, an ethologist and evolutionary biologist, particularly helpful. Play is behavior that is non-functional, voluntary, characterized by repeated but various movements, and occurring only when the animal is healthy, safe, and well-fed. Toomey's own bent is towards the broader context of evolutionary biology and how play may have evolved. Clearly, play provides novelty, excitement, sensation. Research suggests that human children deprived of play can develop serious difficulties. Some believe that repetitive behaviors seen in isolated zoo animals, such as pacing and rocking, may be the result of an environment barren of stimulation. Although humans tend to combine novelty, excitement, and sensation, called something called fun, many ethologists have found the idea non-functional behavior a serious challenge to their perspective on other species. Play promotes physical strength and group bonding, teaches social skills, and relieves stress. Therefore, in their view, play is an adaptation, and they are prone to consider play as a neurological drive, an instinct, or social response. Play fighting, one of the most common forms of social play in the world, is a good example. Humans do it, of course. It explains everything from the brutal Red Rover games of my childhood to Call of Duty. Magpies play fight too. So do gorillas, meerkats, voles, and gerbils. Kangaroos engage in formal boxing matches, their bouts beginning only after one has accepted an invitation from another. Rats spar in a series of gentle attacks, escapes, and counterattacks. Most of the time, nobody gets hurt. We can see a dozen different skills at work. But many animals also engage in behaviors with no obvious benefit, which doesn't deter the scientist's quest to find one, Toomey observes. Piglets often run around and occasionally perform a kind of flip. Researchers have been inclined to see this as skill building. We hypothesize, as one group puts it, that a major ancestral function of play is to rehearse behavioral sequences in which animals lose full control of their locomotion, position, or sensory spatial input and need to repair those facilities quickly. A routine that that group called training for the unexpected. In other words, Toomey writes, the piglet undertakes the flop over not for its own sake, but of anticipation of the moment immediately after the flop over when it recovers and regains control. Bemused, he adds, that most observers recognize that a somersault appears thrilling to piglets and that falling down seems to be the point. The search for utility sometimes fails, which can frustrate ethologists intent on discovering adaptive advantages. Toomey describes the way South American fur seal pups in Punta San Juan will goof around in tidal pools, even though at risk an attack by sea lions. Just one example of overtly dangerous forms of play. Describing the conundrum presented by a puppy in the snow, he drearily writes, the puppy's pleasure is self-evident, but for many hypotheses of animal play, difficult to explain. The puppy will find its movements inhibited, and if the snow is deep enough, its vision compromised. How can that be fun? Toomey offers other examples of animal behavior that appears non-functional. Many people have reported watching elephants slide down muddy embankments, appearing to deliberately collide with other elephants climbing up. They do it again and again. Describing a turtle that shared a tank with a nurse shark, Toomey notes that now and then, the turtle will carefully bite the shark's tail just hard enough that the shark pulled the turtle around as it swam. A group of 45 bees was allowed to walk along a path that offered both food and small wooden balls. Individual bees stopped and pushed the balls back and forth. Some bees did it only once, but others came back for weeks to roll the balls again and again. When you pause to think about it, an array of behavior that confounds ready categorizing as adaptive is delightfully broad. Before orcas began ramming yachts, they had what happened to be a fashion trend of wearing dead fish on their heads. Songbirds sometimes sing when they're alone, repeating a phrase or trill. Several times they seem to be singing simply for the sake of it. I had a golden retriever who would drop his beloved tennis ball on the eddy of a fast river and nudge the ball to the very edge of the current, waiting until the last possible chance to snatch it out. A grainy video online of a crow in Russia shows the bird carrying a jar lid to the peak of a roof, climbing in and snowboarding down. The crow does this several times. Toomey describes a group of common eaters gliding down a river's rapids and hurrying back to the spot from which they began to have another go. Perhaps you can fly. Sliding is particularly exciting. In the end, the belief that animals are no less complex and mysterious than humans prevails in Kingdom of Play. Toomey understands that if we always reduce play to some form of utility, we are returning animals to the status of automatons. As the book winds down, his own enjoyment of the subject comes to the fore. He follows a few unexpected tangents along them, several stories about people whose deep sense of wonder at the lives of other species inspires them to extreme attempts at immersion in their existence. He describes a man who lived among goats in Switzerland, wearing hoof prosthesis on his hands and feet and going on all fours, and a British veterinarian who tried to share in the aroma-rich world of a badger by crawling in the grass, smelling the ground as he moved. He ate earthworms for a time. We may ever be in the dark about animals' inner lives, but how much darker life is if we turn away because of that? Of course, the real question isn't whether animals play, but how to understand what is happening when they do. If we can conceive of an animal simply having fun, we can no longer see animals as mere objects. We are challenged to change the way we treat them, and a solemn responsibility is added to our domination. Somersaulting may be good training for the unexpected, but I wonder, why is it so hard to believe that exuberance is in itself a good? We can meet our fellow animals in the most surprising ways. An orangutan watches a person perform the cup and ball trick, putting a ball inside one of several cups, overturning them, and shuffling them around. The animal observes closely, Toomey writes, until the performance's conclusion, when it's shown that the cup it thought would hold a ball is empty. Staring into the cup, confirming that against expectations it is empty, the orangutan rolls onto its back with obvious delight. The orangutan is not just playing, it has been played, and finds this to be an excellent joke. And that was Why Do Animals Play? By Sally Tisdale in the Atlantic Magazine, the April 2024 issue. And that will do it for this week's Points of View. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen. It has been a pleasure reading for you, and we will talk to you next week.